This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The Cape Coast Castle, we stood before the door of no return, where countless millions caught their last glimpse of Africa.
That's Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi, who addressed Ghana's parliament. Details next. Also, today the Dusit D2 Hotel and Business Complex in Nairobi that was a target of terrorist attacks 6 months ago has reopened. And the man who was the second confirmed Ebola patient in the city of Goma died today. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, today told Ghana's parliament her visit to the country has been transformative. She arrived in the West African nation in Ghana on Sunday with members of the Black Caucus. Pelosi said the visit of the West African nation was about both acknowledging the past and looking to the future. Pelosi and members of the Black Caucus, including Karen Bass, Ilhan Omar, and John Lewis, met with Ghana's president, Nana Akufo-Addo. They also visited Ghana's historic Cape Coast and Ilimina castles, where millions of Africans were shipped to the Americas. This month marks the 400th anniversary of the beginning of the transatlantic slave trade.
Our delegation has been humbled by what we have seen this week. At Elmina Castle, we saw the dungeons where thousands were grotesquely tortured. At Cape Coast Castle, we stood before the door of no return, where countless millions caught their last glimpse of Africa before they were shipped to a life of enslavement. Being here has been a transformative experience for all of us, even if you had been here before.
The visit has had a strong emphasis on economic and trade ties between the two nations.
America is firmly committed to economic progress in Ghana, a commitment enshrined and advanced over the course of many years through the Millennium Challenge Partnership and in the African Growth and Opportunities Act.
Before arriving in Ghana, the delegation visited the U.S. Army Africa Command in Italy. On January 15th, five militants stormed the Dusit D2 Hotel and Business Complex in Nairobi and killed at least 21 people. The attack by heavily armed extremists using guns and explosives demonstrated Al-Shabaab's continued ability to strike the capital. Of the civilians who lost their lives that day, 16 were Kenyan, one was British, one was American, and three were from other African nations. Today, the Dusit D2 Hotel and Business Complex in Nairobi celebrated its full reopening. I first asked our reporter in Nairobi, Mohamed Yusuf, to talk to us about the significance of the opening.
Just to make it very clear, today the reopening itself, around morning hours, there's been motorbikes driving around several roads in Nairobi, flying the Dusit 2 flag, which is orange in color, and the Kenyan national flag, just to symbolize and show that this hotel 6 months ago was under attack by Al-Shabaab, but now it's going to be a free place where people can come again and enjoy life. And the reopening began by raising the flag, of course, the hotel flag, which I've mentioned, which is orange in color, and the Kenyan national flag. Several ministers attended the ceremony, and the significance, one of the ministers, the tourism minister, said that Kenya is stronger than the evil forces, of course, referring to Al-Shabaab members who were attacked. And that's a very strong message to Al-Shabaab, that life will go on no matter what they do, and Kenya will always be above the men and women who are organizing terror attacks against the country and its people.
The ceremony seems very impressive, but Mohammed, what concrete steps have been taken by the government or even the hotel complex to prevent a repeat of what happened?
Of course, as you will expect, when there's such an attack, because it took a very long time for such a hotel to reopen, one thing that is so clear is that this has been going on. And what I do understand is there's been the government security agencies and the management have been talking back and forth, trying to see ways they can improve the security around the area. And for 6 months, of course, the security agencies, they have seen some lapses here and there, and then have given their recommendation. And of course, the other biggest challenge is how do you overcome this kind of emotion? So remember, there were people who were involved living in that hotel. There were people working in offices within the complex. And will these people, these offices come back again? Will these people willing to come back? I think this is what the hotel has been working on. And by them to come out clearly today to reopen the hotel and back to business, then it clearly shows that these are some things that they have agreed, they have sorted out. And they're going to put a very strong security mechanism on way forward now on how to prevent such attack that does not repeat again.
And lastly, Mohammed, all five militants who stormed the hotel and business complex were killed, and Somali-based Islamist group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility. So is the case closed, or is there an investigation into attacks still proceeding?
What is basically happening is that the government has made dozens of arrests before some were released after interrogation, but about five suspects were presented to the court, and at the time the investigators, they've asked for more time to investigate these people, and since then they haven't been brought in front of a judge. So basically it seems that the investigation is still ongoing. It's just recently that we just concluded the man who's suspected to have carried out or involved in Garissa University, which happened in 2014. And this is going to take the same length or the same time to conclude this kind of cases.
That was Mohammed Yusuf in Nairobi talking to me about the opening of the Dusit D2 Hotel and Business Complex in Nairobi. The Islamic State militants today claimed they had killed or wounded more than 40 soldiers in the northeast Nigerian city of Borno. The unconfirmed report says the group's fighters attacked a military post in Baga yesterday and an army barracks in the town of Benshek. Area residents told the Reuters news agency there were clashes between insurgents and soldiers on Monday and Tuesday. On Monday, the Nigerian military said it had killed 10 fighters with the Islamic State West Africa province near Baga. The army said the militants attacked a base for a multinational force battling the insurgency in the northeast. The military said one soldier died in the fighting and five were wounded. Northeastern Nigeria has suffered through a decade of extremist attacks, which began with the rise of the Islamist extremist group Boko Haram. Islamic State militants have moved into the region in the past few years. More than 30,000 people have died in the insurgency. U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper this week made with Egyptian Defense Minister General Mohamed Zaki in Washington. The two had a host of issues to discuss, including mutual security concerns in the Middle East, strengthening military cooperation, and counterterrorism efforts. Esper said the strategic relationship with Egypt is a top priority for this administration and expressed U.S. interest in expanding counterterrorism cooperation with Cairo. David DeRoche, associate professor at the National Defense University, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi about the significance of the talks and about the Egyptian campaign to uproot terrorism in the Sinai.
Well, according to my information, both are somehow correct. The truth is in between. The LNA advanced a couple of kilometers from the previous front lines. They reached the Gaddafi farms about 5 kilometers north of Tripoli International Airport. This is about 3 kilometers of advance. Saladin district about 10 kilometers south of the center. Farnach district about 9 kilometers southwest of the center. They are still pushing, but they are far from achieving a major breakthrough. So on this, with this regard, the GNA is correct. They suffered some casualties, but inflicted many more on the pro-GNA militias. So with this respect, the LNA is correct. Most of the LNA casualties, by the way, were from airstrikes from combat drones provided and operated by Turkey.
So the United Nations mission in Libya said that it was talking with all local and foreign actors to avoid military escalation and to ensure protection of civilians. Would that work?
Avoiding a military escalation? I don't think so. There is already a military escalation, and both sides have no interest in a ceasefire whatsoever. The pro-GNA militias believe that they can hold the defensive lines that they are currently having, and if there would be a ceasefire, they fear that the LNA would use the time to get in some reinforcements and attack thereafter even more fearful than right now. On the other side, the LNA believes that they are close to a breakthrough. I said it before, I have some doubts about this, but nevertheless, they believe it, and so they will certainly not accept a ceasefire. Protection of civilians, for the time being, it more or less works. And it will work as long as the defenders don't establish a new line of defense in the densely populated parts of Tripoli. For the time being, all the fighting is more or less on the outskirts of Tripoli, which is evacuated by civilians. And this is the reason why, fortunately, the number of civilian casualties is, for the time being, rather low.
The High Council of the State in Libya has revealed that Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and France are backing Libyan General Haftar in carrying out a new attack on Libyan capital. The three states, however, were among the 6 states which signed a joint statement a few days ago calling for a ceasefire. How would you explain such contradiction?
Actually, as you said, they are supporting the Libyan National Army and demanding at the same time a ceasefire is not really logical. It's more for the media warfare. But we need to be aware that both sides have significant international support. While on one side, Egypt and the UAE are supporting with logistics and training, just short of direct involvement for the time being, UAE delivered also combat drones and turboprop light attack aircraft a couple of years ago, and those aircraft are the mainstay of the LNA advance on Tripoli. France is cooperating with the LNA with regards to counterterrorism in Fezzan. This is their main focus for the time being. But on the other side, Turkey and Qatar are providing logistic and training support. As mentioned before, Turkey is even directly operating combat drones for the GNA, and they are their most successful weapon for the time being. They are inflicting really heavy casualties on the side of the Libyan National Army. I would say GNA and LNA do not need to blame each other for receiving international support. Both are receiving this kind of support.
That was David Deroche, associate professor at the National Defense University. He spoke with my colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawi. Eighteen past the hour, you're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The man who was the second confirmed Ebola patient in the city of Goma died today. Officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo say the man had returned home to the eastern city from the area in Ituri province, where no cases of the deadly virus have been reported. World Health Organization officials say he may have been exposed to it on his journey home, which took several days. The latest patient does not seem linked to the first one found in Goma 2 weeks ago, but any cases in the city of more than 1 million residents causes concern that the virus could spread quickly in crowded areas near the border with Rwanda. The DRC has been battling an Ebola outbreak for a year in the country's eastern provinces. More than 1,800 people have died. Hundreds of Zimbabweans living illegally in Botswana face an uncertain future after authorities in Habrone ordered local residents to evict them from their homes. Botswana deports an estimated 30,000 illegal immigrants from the neighboring country every year. From Habrone, Botswana, Mokandisi Dube reports.
Botswana is battling rising numbers of illegal immigrants entering the country from crisis-ridden neighbor Zimbabwe. An estimated 1,000 people cross into Botswana through unauthorized points, most in search of employment. The majority of Zimbabwean immigrants line the streets of the capital Gaborone looking for odd jobs. Locals complain, arguing the influx has led to a rise in crime. Regular police roundups do not yield much as immigrants are back in the country as soon as they are deported. Now the police and immigration officials have told citizens to evict any illegal immigrant staying in their homes. A member of parliament, Sidiro Korowa, says his constituency of Mohotisani is now a haven of crime due to the high number of illegal immigrants.
We cannot be bragging about 54 years of independence when in actual fact we are prisoners in our own country, prisoners to criminals.
The legislator called for the redeployment of the army to assist the police clean the streets. The latest clampdown on immigrants is not good news for 33-year-old Zimbabwean Ethel Ngoma, who stayed in Botswana for the last 6 years without the required legal documents. She says with the landlords told to evict them, it would be difficult to remain in the diamond-rich country.
We had found refuge in Botswana, and despite being an illegal immigrant, we have been able to survive. But now there are people who are telling our landlords to evict us, and that's probably the last straw.
Ngoma is a qualified teacher but survived through menial jobs in Botswana, which she says is better than the bleak prospects she faces back home.
It keeps getting worse. I cannot even imagine myself going back to Zimbabwe. There are no employment prospects there. I'd rather cross over to South Africa, even if I know that over there they also treat foreigners badly, but I'd rather go there than to return home.
There are sporadic xenophobic attacks in South Africa, with clashes often turning deadly. While Ngoma and many other Zimbabwean immigrants are pushed back, Botswana has extended welcoming arms to visitors from neighboring Namibia. The two countries have agreed to scrap the use of passports and instead use identity cards. Namibia recently said the influx of Zimbabwean immigrants was overwhelming as they compete for job opportunities with locals. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
Zimbabwe has a long history of cracking down on free expression, starting during the early years of President Robert Mugabe's government. The new administration says it is changing that stance, but the recent arrest of screenwriters in Harare during a film screening raises questions. Reporter Kuzaza Nawashi has the details.
Devs Kuja is a veteran scriptwriter, and he is among four screenwriters who were arrested for screening a film.
The arrest and arraignment of Dave Guja, producer, and Peter Churu, creative director, Theatre in the Park, together with Tendai Madua and Kudakwashe Bwititi, the producers of Lord of Kush, represents an unfortunate law in the relationship between the creative sector and state governance systems in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe Republic police were clumsy in the way that they carried out their mandate. It is our belief that this was an abuse of their constitutional powers and a blatant violation of our artistic and constitutional freedoms.
Tendai Madua gives a synopsis of the film, Lord of Kush, which prompted the arrests on Saturday.
Lord of Kush is a work of fiction. It's not a documentary film. It's a work of fiction inspired by a real incident that happened in Pakistan. We have a diplomatic family of Zimbabwe in Kush, so to speak. So this diplomatic family is a Christian family from a Christian background in a Muslim economy. So that's where our script centered around.
Kusha says the build-up to the screening was telling. The day before the screening, they got a visit from the Office of the President and Cabinet, also known as OPC.
When OPC came in on Friday, they were very clear in their minds that they had actually received a phone call. They said, we received a phone call from the embassy. And this phone call that is coming through says that whatever you're about to show could be a security threat.
He says they were later given the green light to go ahead with the screening, only to be arrested when the movie was shown. The case is now in the courts, and the four writers are now on bail. They next appear in court on August 29th. Kuja says this will not put a damper on their work or force them to censor themselves. He adds that their arrest under the Censorship and Entertainment Control Act provides a chance to call for the review of this and other laws that contradict the Constitution of Zimbabwe. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Tanzania is planning to build a cable car service on Mount Kilimanjaro, Africa's tallest peak and a World Heritage Site. The country wants to boost tourism, but many of the 250,000 porters and mountain guides worry the quick ride up the mountain is a threat to their livelihoods. Charles Kombe reports from Kilimanjaro.
Kilimanjaro, the tallest mountain in Africa, keeps the town of Moshi, Tanzania, alive with trade and tourism. The mountain is a source of income for many people here, including a 250,000 guys and porters such as 37-year-old Cynthia Mwita. She says the job helps her a lot. She says she has a family of three children, and she's the one who pays for their school fees and daily expenses in her family. But porters and guides fear for their jobs after the government announced the plan this year to build the cable cars on Kilimanjaro. While the government officials say the cable cars will cater to the physical challenged such as elderly and children, it will also help tourists get up the mountain faster. Jennifer Francis is a deputy chairman for Kilimeru Mountain Guide Society. She says the government hasn't been as transparent as it could be regarding the project. She says authorities gave them only the advantages of the project without telling them the negative effects on the current and the next generation. Around 50,000 tourists climb Kilimanjaro annually, bringing tens of millions of dollars to the region. Tanzanian authorities say cable cars will increase tourist numbers by as much as 50% by providing easy access to the mountain. Constantine Kanyasu is the Deputy Minister of Natural Resources and Tourism. Kanyasu believes the project will be a big plus for tourism industry in Tanzania, but concedes change isn't easy.
We expect more camping on top of the mountain than this one. And that should not be the worry of our people that they're going to lose the job. Of course, changes comes with some effects. We should not expect Tanzania to be the same in 100 years to come. And we should not have a nation that is prepared to be porters for lifetime. No, we need to have changes.
Tanzania is carrying out a social and environmental impact assessment before construction on the Kilimanjaro cable car system begins. Edson Matauna is the deputy chairman for Mount Kilimanjaro Porters Society. He says if their jobs will be assured and that the clients in the cable cars will have no effect on them, then he thinks there will be no tension between porters and the government. While the government plans for cable cars on Mount Kilimanjaro, porters such as Mwita feel strongly the authority should take a harder look at the project. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Kilimanjaro, Tanzania.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London!
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Whoa. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. win prizes, and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Ah. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America. Stand up!